I'm speaking today with Sarah Hickman, a social worker in palliative care who works in healthcare systems in the Portland metropolitan area, Vancouver, and in Cowlitz County. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today to talk about end-of-life care work during the pandemic.
Yeah, no problem.
Tell us a little bit about what it's like to be working with people at the end of their life during the pandemic.
I think a lot has changed in the last couple years since COVID hit. I think end-of-life care is different in a lot of ways. We're working in a system that was already taxed quite a bit prior to hitting the pandemic, and the pandemic really magnified a lot of the challenges that the healthcare system already had in place. Some of the ways that people are impacted are families are not getting the care they're needing, and a lot of our patients are dying faster than they used to. Some of our patients are waiting long periods of time to get caregiving support. We ran out of hospital beds at one point. We've ran out of oxygen. Our patients can't see the doctors anymore that they need to see to get follow-up care. The surgeries are all canceled, and a lot of people are really stressed, so the mental health of our community is really stretched thin. And changes are wide-ranging, and I think we aren't going to even know the impact of how things have changed for end-of-life care for a very long time. And palliative care has changed in a lot of ways because we're having conversations with folks around whether or not they want to be intubated or whether they want to have certain types of treatments. And there's a lot of conversations with folks about providing care in the community versus the hospital. That's been a huge change. People are not really going into the hospital anymore as much as they used to. I think people are scared to seek treatment. There's a lot of people that are frightened. They're scared that they're going to not be able to see their loved one if they go into the hospital. And so I'm part of an outpatient group of folks right now. My role works in a lot of the homes and facilities around here, and I'm starting to see a lot of insurance companies provide outpatient care. So I roam around and help and support folks in the community, and so is a lot of these insurance companies. So I've noticed a lot of people getting additional supports from outfits like Humana. They have their own visiting nurse practitioner team that comes out and sees people. And it's really interesting because no one's communicating with each other. So I might go visit a patient, and so does multiple other providers, and we aren't talking to each other. And so what does that mean for the patient, their continuity of care? What does that mean for their outcomes, right? Is if we're all doing different things, or we're all redoing the same work, is that a good use of services? Are we good being good stewards of our resources? So it's magnified some of the challenges and the disorganization that's taking place. And I'm in my 30s, and so I'll probably be supporting an aging population that's going to be booming here in another 10 years. And so I'm really nervous. We don't have people to care for the folks that are aging. So It's a scary time, but it has changed a lot of how people are seeking care and what that care looks like.
We know there were already issues, holes, and weaknesses in our healthcare system, and it sounds like COVID has really magnified those issues and placed much greater system level constraints on you and the frontline workers who've been almost for 2 years now just working exhausting hours with less resources to work with and higher demand. It seems there's just this incredible increase in demand for healthcare services across the board. How has that shaped your job? Are you finding that you're doing different things now as a social worker than before the pandemic? You had to acquire a whole new set of skills and do services outside of palliative care because of the demands of COVID on our healthcare system?
Sure. It's really just crisis work, right? It's not, you know, having conversations and drinking tea anymore and discussing what you want the end of life care to look like. It's people who are struggling at home. Just last week, I drove 45 minutes to a man's home to bring him water bottles. His wife and him live alone. They don't have kids. And he had fallen and hurt himself a month and a half prior, and his wife fell over the weekend and now she was hospitalized. And he told me, you know, I just can't bring water to my recliner with my walker because I can't hold the water bottle and use my walker. And there was no one to help him, and he hadn't showered in a while, and his wife was the one that was helping him prior. And it's just those basic things. So I drove a case of water out to him and left it next to his recliner where he was going to sit. But it wasn't like that before. We could have hired a caregiver. This family has money, so they could have hired a caregiver, but there just wasn't people that we could hire at that point. So his wife had been looking for someone, but they just didn't have, and they live out in the rural areas, so that's part of what happens is our rural communities are obviously going to be hit first and hardest. They're struggling to get people to go out and care for folks who are living and aging in our community out in the rural areas. And then it, you know, trickles down. We see a lot of our minority population being impacted differently. They are left behind because when crisis work takes place, we just know when people are in crisis, they're not thinking, oh, maybe we should put this information in multiple languages. Maybe we should, you know, find ways to communicate to people.
So accessibility is a huge issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing crisis work, people are in crisis mode, and so they don't do those extra pieces. They don't think about the ways you can, you know, make things equal because things are so stressed and stretched thin. So, you know, there's times when people may not understand their choices that they're making. They may not understand how to access the resources. They may not know what's available to them. And it's all because of how things are distributed. We expect people to log into their healthcare website, make an attempt to communicate with their doctors via this healthcare online tool. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have internet or you don't have, you know, access to a smartphone or a device that can upload it in the way that we have it set up, then you're not going to be able to do that. And then you're tasked with calling your doctor's office. And I know because I spend a lot of time calling doctor's offices that you sit on hold for 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes. Some people tell us hours when they're Medicaid and they're low income and they're going to see CMAR or one of our Medicaid providers. They don't have people to answer the phones. They don't have staffing.
So there's real structural barriers to accessibility for people in rural areas, for people who don't have their children or other adults in their community to provide support for basic needs. Mm-hmm. And so your role from beyond giving palliative care to people who are trying to end their life in a good way with dignity and support are having to really feel the shock of this because it sounds like there's not really enough workers to fill all the caregiving roles now because we've got such a high demand of people needing care. What does that look like in the hospital setting? You had mentioned to me before that you worked 33 days in a row mm-hmm. recently and that you were doing jobs that people who had been part of the Great Resignation, part of the millions of workers in the U.S. over the last few months who've quit their jobs, you're filling those holes. So what's that like for you in the hospital setting?
In the hospital setting, it's a different monster. There's not a lot of people covering shifts, so people are stressed out. Every department is stressed out. Most of the folks that are working have been doing the same thing I've been doing, covering extra shifts. There's a lot of extra money kind of floating around, but it's not given out equally, so everybody's pissed off at each other and pitted against one another. We have traveling providers coming in and they're making double what you're making, and it doesn't feel good because you're the one that's working for the system and putting in all the extra time to stay on and following through with all the requirements that they're putting in place now. And so there's a lot of, you know, things that are different for a lot of people. And one of the ways we help out in hospital settings is letting families have access to their loved ones. They aren't allowed to go in and say goodbye. Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. It really just depends on the situation. Specifically for me, my role would change based off of what the need was. So I work both hospice and palliative care and in multiple hospital settings. So when I work hospice in the hospital, it's really overwhelming. Part of the role is kind of figuring out why someone's dying, and there's COVID on board or multiple different things going on and someone's very sick, it can be very stressful. And what has happened is the hospitals that I'm working in a third of the population is referred for palliative care, and then they have really large lists of hospice patients. So if you're just one employee and you have, you know, 30 patients that you need to see that are all dying, you know that there's probably going to be about five or six of those that are just going to die and you're not going to have any interaction with. And so what I see is that people are missing the care that they need. And when you have a loved one dying in the hospital and you don't know what's going on, and someone, there's not enough people to call you and tell you what's going on. And I have heard families say, I've called multiple times to find out how my mom is, and no one's told them and no one's called them back. And it's because the nurse is running her hiney off just trying to meet the needs of the patients and take care of them. And so, you know, it's overwhelming and stressful for the people in those settings. And if you do that work day in and day out, it is trauma work. It's like working in a trauma setting. And there needs to be specific trauma therapy at that point for those workers, because we're going to see long-term mental health effects from the people doing this. And the people that know how to protect themselves and get through the work are the ones that are going to be able to stay in it long-term. But that's why we're seeing so many people leave, is that they don't have the coping skills to protect themselves through constant trauma. And who does?
And the workplace doesn't have the supports for workers who need to do basic self-care and not work 33 days in a row.
Well, and a lot of us aren't thinking clearly, right? There's not a lot of, you know, people are having sleep issues. They're having just basic, trying to make their basic needs met. The pandemic has impacted a lot of the people's personal lives. And so when you're mentally not doing well, and then you're expected to work and be the same worker you were before in an environment that's completely different, the stress is higher and people who pick that up.
You've mentioned that your workplace isn't unionized, but we've talked before about how there are other health systems that have unionized workers, Kaiser, for example. And Kaiser unions are part of the big Striketober movement of, there's up to 50,000 healthcare workers nationally who are trying right now to bargain for a reasonable contract, and one that doesn't create this two-tier system of workers where the new hires get the same kinds of working conditions but even less compensation from hospital CEOs. If you were to write a letter with your colleagues and your peers right now to the hospital CEO where you work, what would you say you need in order to continue to help people die with dignity and have their family members supporting them and have their basic needs met?
I would say that I think equal pay is really important. I think it feels bad to have people making twice as much doing the same job alongside you. And I think that, you know, making sure that your employees are well cared for is really important. A lot of our lives have changed and have been impacted financially. There's things that have changed for all of us, and money does help make those things, you know, alleviate problem. So I am a huge fan of those bonuses that they've been giving out to the nurses. But the thing is that this is just the beginning, and I don't know how long you can just give out bonuses to people. So creating structural change is going to have to, you know, start at the top, and it has to start with our healthcare system as a whole. And we're going to need to implement a Medicare for all system. It's just how it's going to have to be. We don't have the skill set to take care of an aging population.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing about your work, especially the care work that you do for folks during the pandemic. You are an essential frontline worker that's keeping us all going. And I just really want to honor the work that you've done and what you've shared with us today. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.